Good morning, everyone. Sorry that you're going to have to deal with me two talks in a row, but we'll see how the second one goes. Ron has high hopes for my second talk I'll be giving for someone else. So first talk here, I'm going to talk a little bit about the idea of fake forests. I used to be a field researcher, and now my current job keeps me basically in the office, and so I need to like at least do something, and so I create my little fake worlds. So I'd just like to start the talk. I had this professor once a long time ago who was very wise but completely scary. You'd give a talk and he'd look at you and say, "I'm just a simple chemist, you know, obviously world-renowned kind of person." And he'd say, "Well, so what? Why do I care about what you're going to talk about today, you know?" And so hopefully we've been talking a lot about uncertainty and trying to get at and understand our systems and what's happening. A lot of times, though, there is the best practices. You know, we do our good sample designs. We collect enough samples to at least understand what our errors are. But a lot of times in the real world, that doesn't happen. You may be using data or using equations that have been collected by someone else, and not all the proper information was published. And you need to try and at least get at, well, what does this mean? What is the uncertainty on these sorts of estimates? And what are we trying to do? And so sometimes, instead of crunching the numbers, it's good maybe to take a step back and start doing some thought experiments. It's like, well, what does it mean if we have uncertainties of this? Or what are the principal components to our uncertainty? And all this kind of came out, started as a talk. Well, one day we were trying to look at the Mexico National Forest Inventory there. And in Mexico, they happen to have about, for their biomass estimations, they had about 500 and some odd allometric equations that they'd collected from a bunch of different researchers around the country. And so there were actually instances where they had to choose between which model they wanted to use, and they had sort of a decision tree set up. Well, if it's in this region and we have this species, we'll use this equation, and if we don't, then we're going to choose, you know, the equation with the highest R square, you know, and so on and so forth, to try and narrow down what equation they wanted to use. And I was sitting there and I looked at them and it seemed reasonable, their little decision tree, and then I was like, but how do you know that those rules are the rules that are going to give you the lowest uncertainty on your estimates? And they kind of looked at me and said, well, I guess we don't know, it just seems logical. And so I was like, well, how could we test these assumptions that you've made? And everybody was like, well, it's the whole idea of model selection. What do we do? Well, it's kind of hard to tell that if you don't have this good background data, hardcore real data, to do these tests to. And so I was like, well, what if we created a fake forest? And so as you'll see, don't want to blast anybody, you know, all good ideas start on a whiteboard or a napkin, right? And so we started sketching out, well, what are the things that we need to know to test against on our fake forest? You know, so we're just drawing on our whiteboard there and figuring out, well, setting up our experiment, and kind of went from there. So when we're go ahead and try and create our fake forest, we wanted to make it at least realistically a fake forest. But the idea behind this forest that we're making here was to go ahead and produce something with a known biomass. We know exactly what it is because we made it. It's in our computer world there. And so we're working on trying to make it as real as possible. Well, luckily we do have some data. We have at least an idea of, using the National Forest Inventory, the amount. We had a distribution of diameters that they had across the country. So we understood, well, what are the size variabilities? What are the biomass or the DBH distributions going through? And so we started making a forest that was based on that. Now, obviously it wouldn't be terribly useful if we created a fake forest that we knew exactly everything was about, but we also knew that we needed to introduce some random error into there, right? Well, how much random error in our forest, right? The larger diameter trees have a variability associated with them, and the smaller diameters less so, but there is a variability. So where are we going to get that information to figure out how much variability we should add? And luckily, due to some other work that we'd been doing on trying to recuperate parameter estimates for some other work with allometric equations, we had access to a pretty big database that they set out and did in Canada, where they've cut down, I think all told there's like 14,000 trees in this database, different, maybe 20 different species, where they actually have cut down these trees and weighed them. So we, at least we had an idea. Well, okay, what is the variability of these larger size diameters that we would see, and so on and so forth. And so we built that in to our forest. So what we did is we went ahead and calculated a biomass using a pretty standard equation here, and just some sort of random parameters that we thought seemed reasonable for this. And we went ahead, and after, you know, we went through, and then we did a little process where we're taking that and adjusting it and introducing some variability into there. Now the interesting thing was is that now we actually have a reasonable facsimile of a forest of 100,000 trees in this case, to which we could go ahead and start testing these assumptions. Well, what if you created an allometric equation based on a small number of n? Well, what was the distribution of n, et cetera, et cetera? So these are sort of the things that we're trying to look at. Oddly enough, creating this fake forest looks like a lot of work there, but it was actually only about 5 lines of real code here in MATLAB. I actually went ahead and commented it out pretty well, which is something unusual for me to do, but it was good because now I actually remember exactly what we did. So once we had our fake forest, we knew exactly how much it weighed. And so what we did then is we started looking at, well, if our population is this of the trees, and we wanted to create an equation that would succinctly describe that and do as good as possible, you know, how many trees would we need to sample out of that to understand and describe our population? And after dealing sort of the naming approach, we found that about 104 trees, if we were going to pull out of there to create an equation, an allometric equation to estimate the biomass, and we were also able to distribute them across these DBH ranges. And so then we knew that, you know, to do well, because of the distribution in our forest, you know, if we had about 40 trees in this smaller class, so on and so forth, working up, that would be our optimal solution to create a model, right? Now, when I say the real world, that's great. Oftentimes, we don't have this. We're pulling equations from other researchers. They've used different diameter classes. They use different sampling approaches. They use different model types. So what we wanted to do is go ahead and kind of test some of these assumptions. So here across the top, we're looking at, we know our optimal number of samples that we should have in order to describe this population. But what we did is we said, well, what if we had less and less and less numbers of trees? Oftentimes these biomass equations are generated with, you know, 14 trees, say in the case of the Hover Brook there. It's rare to find 100 trees to produce one biomass model. It's usually in the range of 14, 15 trees. And so what is the effect does that number have on the uncertainty of those estimates produced out of there? Well, because we're ambitious, we didn't want to stop there. We wanted to also look at the distribution, right? So a lot of times we cut down these really small trees because they're easier to deal with. You don't want to cut down the big giant trees because it's harder to find and do. Well, what does that mean when we're starting to shift the sample distribution, not only in terms of N, but also in terms of where they are in those DBH classes? And then just because we wanted to make things more complicated, we've, you know, there were about 9 model types that were pretty common in the Mexico database, right, for allometric equations. And so we started looking at these 9 different ways of calculating biomass. And one of the things people will often do, and I think a little dangerous, is we have a small data set and we'll choose the model that fits our data the best, right? Well, that's great, and you have really high R-squares for that, but what does that mean actually on when you're trying to say something about the population as a whole? So we wanted to investigate a little bit about choosing different models based on different concentration distributions of the N across the range and the N in the input into that model. So obviously this is a lot of different runs, and you start getting some of these things like this. So here you've got our, in the black circles, this is the actual fake forest right there. Those are the biomasses. We know what they are because we made them, right? And then as you move across this top row, these are optimum distributions, right? And as you move down, these are using different ends. Sorry, different ends across this way and different distributions down this way. And so what we find is, of course, when we're talking, first of all, the optimals, that Naaman's one, right, that I showed you in the beginning, and then we started basically shifting things more and more and more and more to those smaller trees is how we're going, right? So there's sort of an intermediate shifted, and then there's also a very concentrated in that lowest DBH class. We calculated the R-squared, root mean squared errors, and then the uncertainty, like the true uncertainty, not that it was a sample error. It was like, we know what it is. We know our forest weighs this much. So how much, if we created a model using these different methods and concentrations of DBH, how does that affect our uncertainty? And as you'll notice here, we have these nine models that I was showing you in these different colored lines. And at optimum number and optimum distributions, there's a couple models. You know, a lot of them seem to do reasonably well. But oddly enough, what we found is that there were some model forms that even under considered our optimal, that didn't really do very well at describing our population. And so as you look, some models are a little more resistant. Model forms are a little more resistant to, excuse me, to shifting numbers or the concentrations, right? They seem to perform well. Models that perform poorly under the optimal conditions can actually come back under really not so good conditions and produce a really good estimate. And that was something that was we were finding out to be pretty interesting. Now, when you get down here with the small numbers and horrible distributions, none of the models did very well at all, right? So that's something to be aware of. Where are you at in these model choices and the numbers that were used to create those models and the distributions that you used to create those, right? So that's one of the things we started finding out, was that it really was quite variable. Some models did well, some models did horrible, but sometimes some came back in line and performed better under the different conditions, okay? And so that's one of the things that we are trying to understand and look at. And so when we take a look at these and these horrible bar graphs, I couldn't think of a better way to present this. On the bottom here, we have, as we're moving from the number of N used in there, the 1, 3, and 6, of course, represent the concentration differences we were using. And these are also the different model types. We've narrowed it down. Instead of looking at all nine, we're only going to show you three examples here. And as you can see, under the root mean squared errors, sometimes can actually be quite low because they're fitting to our data. But when you start comparing that and an actual uncertainty of our forest as a whole, these models that seem to perform well for our data actually are not so well when it comes to talking about the population that we're trying to understand or we're trying to estimate here, right? Now, one of the things that I should say, this is sort of a one-run deal. Obviously, what we're really interested in is understanding the, we've chosen at random our DBHs that we're going to put in and create our allometric model. And these are sort of the root mean squared errors we get, and these are the uncertainties that they produce. Now, obviously, this is just one deal, and we happen to choose a really bad draw for a particular model, and it produces really bad results. Well, what if we did that 10,000 times and kept choosing samples, even though they were perhaps concentrated or an intermediate or an optimal concentration? What does that mean in terms of the distribution of uncertainties? And that's something that we haven't shown here, and we're trying to work on that. But as you see, as we move up in N, it tends to, even on that sort of sample draw there, we tend to do a little bit better. Most of the models generally do well, of the ones we're showing here, but not always. Even under optimal conditions, some of our model choices are not that well. Right? So, what have we learned? Well, obviously these are things that you're probably like, yeah, duh. Of course, right? The sample size and diameter distribution ranges change what model to choose, right? Some do quite well over certain ranges and some do poor. The total uncertainty on the predictions decreases when models were developed with larger and better samples. Now, one of the things that we do need to do is go back and confirm that, right? We need to run this 10,000 times, pull out, create our models over and over and over again, and actually look at those distributions, right, and see what's going on there. One of the things that in their original tree that they designed was they relied a lot on the root mean squared error because they thought that was the better way to go. But one of the things that they didn't really take into account when they did that is they were saying, well, we'll just choose the thing with the smallest root mean squared error. But what they forgot to realize was that that scales with size, right? So maybe they were choosing a model that had a really low root mean squared error, but it was because it was built over a small range and could only talk about trees from 10 centimeters to 15 centimeters DBH. When a model that was perhaps the higher root mean squared error, but had a better range to coverage, it was built with diameters that were out to maybe like 80 centimeter type trees. And that was just one thing that, if you think about it, obviously, that's what you should have done, but they had not really visualized that until we ran this experiment. Another thing interesting, or not so much if you really think about it, the behavior of R-square does not really follow the trends in uncertainty, right? And that's one of the things that I see a lot, is people are like, oh, my allometric equation that we published, we had a 0.98% R-square on that, right? Whether you're doing a log-log or if you're doing it in a nonlinear fitting. Well, that's great, but that's fitting your data. If you don't have a good sample set that you're drawing from, that R square is really kind of meaningless. And R square is always kind of a weird thing to interpret when you're trying to use nonlinear approaches. And so that's one thing that they always have felt, that their R square, the higher R square, produces a better estimate. And that is not necessarily the case. So one of the things that they've already done is they've taken these preliminary results, they've gone back, and they've adjusted their model selection criteria for the forest inventory in Mexico. Now, you'll have the benefit, and I'll show you those 500 equations, how many they actually use here in a few minutes. So, sorry, next steps. Well, what are we going to do? We're having some, when we're creating these models, we're having some convergence issues when we're trying to do this. Eventually, we're going to have to do this time and time and time and time again. And so we're going to maybe look at figuring out a better way to tackle those issues. We need to create a routine to generate different samples of total population. Like I said, we need to run this 10,000 times and take a look at what happens and estimate the uncertainties and the sizes of the predictions for the linear models. It's a little weird, right, because you got to do that back transform and figure that out, and what does that mean? So it makes it a little more complicated. And then estimate these level uncertainties using probably Monte Carlo or maybe Delta. And one thing I'd like to do is, if we do enough of this, start taking a look and generating these uncertainty kind of surfaces and understand, well, what is it that is producing this? Is it the distributions that have the greater effect, or is it the model choice or whatever? And so try and actually do all the combinations possible and take a look at this and see. And so, right, and then we'll do more complete runs to aid in the allometric equation design, really focusing on this idea of sample size and distribution and harvest. Maybe there's some ways we can take this and say, well, your optimal distribution is this, but you only have so much money. So what are the things that you need to look for that could help reduce the cost in creating these allometric equations? And this would hopefully be kind of a guide to do that. So with that, thanks for now. The other one will be shorter, so.
All right, so take a few minutes for questions.
Two comments. First, I've heard several references to fitting the models on a log-log scale, but then back transforming and performing them. I've never, in that context, I've never heard of anybody deal with the bias issue. Because when you fit on a log-log scale and go back to the original scale, you have to do some bias correction factors to be sure you get that. The second is that one of your original slides, you indicated optimal sample size of what, I think it was 150.
you know, we'll see. We've seen before that it's the sample error tends to outclass a lot of these other errors as you propagate across. But there are people who do studies at very much plot level. But for national scale work, right, these errors start getting smaller and smaller and smaller. But, you know, I used to work as a civil engineer, and we used to lay roads, like highways, right? And we would design those roads, and we would put the pin exactly where that road should be within, you know, less than an eighth of an inch. And I was always like, we're building a six-lane interstate here. Well, an eighth of an inch doesn't matter. But one of the things that the engineer told me, he was like, it all adds up in the end, and that we need to be as precise as possible so that in the end we have the best result. So, yeah.
Are we ready to... We'll applaud Craig now, and then we'll bring up